Welcome. My name's Adrian Beebe, and this is the eighth in the series of podcasts about the village of Kington Langley in North Wiltshire. In this episode, we're going to remember the lives of arguably Kington Langley's most famous residents. It's around 30 years since their deaths, and their names have undoubtedly faded. In the spirit of full disclosure, I must confess that until recently, I wasn't aware of them or their achievements. But in some artistic circles, their works are still lauded. In fact, their devotees continue to make pilgrimages to Kington Langley to see the house where they lived and the village that inspired their writings and illustrations. So join me as we explore the lives of Robin and Heather Tanner. You're listening to Memories of Kington Langley.
Episode 8, The Gentle Passions of Robin and Heather Tanner.
I suppose I am one of the last of that pastoral school, the school of etchers who use the countryside of England as their source. Now my work is rather fashionable, people like it, perhaps one day. Soon they won't like it at all. I just don't know. But I can only etch in the way I etch. I'm not consciously a pastoral etcher at all. I etch the things I love, and they come out in that sort of way. I couldn't do it differently.
You're listening to the voice of Robin Tanner, and isn't it brimming with character? He's been dead 32 years, but his image and his voice, and those of his wife Heather, are preserved in a BBC documentary filmed in 1982 in and around their home in Kington Langley. It's called Look Stranger, A Vision of Wiltshire. Look Stranger was a documentary strand on the BBC which focused on communities around the country. In this episode, they filmed the Tanners, already advanced in years, talking about their relationship and their lifelong love of a pastoral Wiltshire that, even in 1982, was slipping away. We see them walking through fields and along woodland paths, pausing to marvel at a wild garlic blossom, or for Robin to sketch a green hellebore while Heather explains the plant's life cycle. In this extract from the programme, Robin explains his love of the Wiltshire countryside.
In these foothills of the Cotswolds, these little grey stone villages with their tiny meadows and hedgerows and woods, I find everything I want to draw, you see. I go dotty about them, just as I suppose a Yorkshireman is about his dales. But I find this is my place. This is where I really belong.
In the programme, Robin and Heather may be in their late 70s, but they're still full of vigour, still mentally sound, their memories intact. They're quite formally dressed. Robin in his rumpled brown suit, braces and tie. Heather in a mustard jacket and matching skirt. Both wear spectacles, Heather's being particularly large. It may be a reference that's dated badly, but Robin reminds me strongly of Mr. Granger from the old comedy show Are You Being Served? Heather is the archetypal schoolmarm, erect, rake-thin, her grey hair scraped flat over her head and held in place with a black band. They met as children at Chippenham Grammar School, now Harden Hewish School, around the time of the First World War. Here, Robin picks up the story.
Our greatest good fortune was to find ourselves in the same form as children. And as sixth formers, we fell in love. And we've been in love ever since.
Robin was born in Bristol in 1904. His family moved to Chippenham while he was young, perhaps because they had relatives in the area. Heather's later writings record that both Robin's mother and grandmother had lived in Kington Langley in the old post office in the Barton on Upper Common. She also notes that Robin's late grandfather was John Collins, the one-time owner of the sawmills just off Parker's Lane. We spoke about him in episode 6. Robin studied illustration and etching at Goldsmiths College in London, the art of transferring a drawing onto a metal plate using acid. The plate is then used to print copies of the drawing. Heather Spackman was born in Corsham in 1903. She studied English, became a teacher for a while before focusing on writing and marrying Robin in Chippenham in 1931. And that's when their association with Kington Langley began. Here's Heather Tanner writing in 1991 about their arrival in the village.
I became an inhabitant of Kington Langley on Saturday, April 4th, 1931. Robin and I had been married at Corsham Church that morning, and after an early lunch with Robin's parents, who then lived in the last house on Sheldon Road, we walked out to our new home. Hungerdown Lane was little more than a lane, elm-lined and dark at night. As at the crossroad, where the lights now control the never-ending traffic, Lord's Barn still asserted small-scale farming. At the top of Harnhewish Hill, we cut the corner by a footpath, lost when Ribbon Building started there, which came out near the golf course. We crossed the Malmesbury Road to Jacksom's Lane, soon abandoned for the path running behind Hicks Farm. Someone caught sight of us and waved, knowing or guessing who we were. Up the hill, through the squeeze belly, and we were at the top of Morrell's Lane, our newly built house in the empty field opposite.
That newly built house was Old Chapel Field. It still stands on the bend at the top of Plough Hill, obscured for the most part by high hedges. But from the road, you can see the roof ridge and the gable end with its dark wood cladding. It was named Old Chapel Field because it was built on land used in the 1700s for the mausoleum of Walter Coleman, the owner of the Langley estate. Here's Heather talking about the house.
We should have liked to have bought and found a good old Cotswold house. But as that was not possible, my uncle offered to design it, the house, for us as a wedding gift. He had hoped that if people liked the house we lived in, others might give him an order for houses. He designed the house with Voysey tradition in mind, and it does resemble very much some of the houses in the Voysey catalogue. And we were very lucky because we had not only an architect uncle, but various craftsmen or workmen in the family who helped to eke out the furniture which my uncle had cleverly designed as part of the house. He designed the bookshelves, the dresser and the wardrobes in as part of the fittings, so that we hadn't got to buy those things. Then Robin's brother, who was a worker in wood, made us that bookcase there. And Robin's father made us various shelves and things, including the dressers.
We started out with the idea, didn't we, that we would have nothing that was manufactured,
yes,
save by our friends and us. And on the whole, I think we've kept to that.
We had to. The house was left just as it had been built, so that we had to start doing things for ourselves straight away.
That's how we
spent
our honeymoon.
And have done ever since, haven't we?
That was our honeymoon, do you remember?
It was.
You got housemaid's knee, I remember. For scrubbing.
In that clip, Heather mentions Voysey and the Voysey catalogue. Voysey was a British architect, Charles Voysey, who worked in the so-called arts and crafts style that was so close to Heather and Robin's hearts. For the rest of their lives, they lived together in Old Chapel Field, the house doubling as studio and workshop, where Robin created his popular etchings and they engaged in a creative partnership that produced 4 books, Robin supplying the illustrations, Heather the words. Here's Heather and Robin talking about their partnership.
I wait till he's done the drawing before I do the writing, because I call attention in the text to something that's fascinated him and made him draw it, obviously. But he's highly critical of my writing and I of his drawing.
In a way, it's a miracle that we've lived in such comparative harmony. But I think a great thing has been that we've both travelled in the same direction, do you see? This love of the natural world has always been basic to us. And it has always seemed right that I should draw and paint and etch, and that she should put down in writing her feeling. But the feeling is common to us both. So that it's very difficult over a book like Woodland Plants to say who did this and who did that. Yes, I actually did all the drawings. Heather did all the writing. But I think the work was conceived in a twin sort of way.
Perhaps most notable among their books was Wiltshire Village, published just before the outbreak of the Second World War. It's set in the fictional village of Kington Burrell, which is, in part, a thinly disguised Kington Langley. This is what one recent reviewer said about the book.
Wiltshire Village is as fresh and vibrant now as the day it was first published, recording what, even then, was a vanishing way of life.
The book is a portrait of life in a small Wiltshire village in the late 1930s. The characters, the crafts, the minutiae of rural life. This is what the Tanners loved. They documented and preserved their memories of a rural Wiltshire that, even then, was coming under pressure from industrialisation and the growth in the use of the motor car. Indeed, the book ends with a lament for the loss of the old village life. This is what Heather wrote.
What always has been, always will be. Birdsong in the small hours, sunrise over the coombe, the farmer calling to his cart horses and slipping halters over their willing necks. The sound of church bells at evening when cottagers tend to their gardens and old men sit on the steps of the market cross.
In 1982, Robin gave a lecture at Bath's Holborn Museum about William Morris, the great Victorian artist whom many saw as the leader of the arts and crafts movement. In that lecture, Robin imagined what Morris, if he were still alive, would think of modern Britain. Robin's words throw as much illumination on his own thoughts as they do Morris's.
He would be outraged. The pylons striding across the landscape would be but one of a thousand unnecessary uglinesses he would deplore. He would loathe the noise of military aeroplanes and would be quick to learn that, without the consent of the people, England has become an occupied country, peppered with American military bases. He would be shocked to learn that our pursuit of nuclear power has already made the Irish Sea the most poisonous in the world, and that the prime purpose of such places as Sellafield is to produce plutonium with which to make bombs capable of annihilating the entire planet, and that it is England that has added most to the acid rain that kills Scandinavian forests. He would be horrified to find that our traditional agriculture is fast being replaced by a greedy monoculture or agribusiness that destroys in its wake our trees and hedgerows, our woodlands and flowery meadows, creating a prairie, and all to satisfy the lust for money.
The Tanners were both Quakers, devoted pacifists and environmentalists. As such, some of their views may not have been entirely palatable for their neighbours. In October 1939, Heather Tanner wrote to the Wiltshire Times and Trowbridge Advertiser, urging the nation to consider peace with Germany, although she clearly had no sympathy for the country's Nazi leaders. "War does not destroy isms, but people," she wrote. While the couple's stance never ignited animosity, they were perceived as a little odd by some.
"Of course, I'm often accused of being an idealist. Actually, I'm very proud to be one. I always feel that the ideal world that I etch and paint could be ours if we had the sense to work for it and do less destruction. That's the thing I slave for. That's where my patriotism runs. I'm really very British, but the Britain I love is that Britain.
The Tanners didn't live alone at Old Chapelfield. In the spring of 1939, around the time Wiltshire Village was published, they took in a 19-year-old German-Jewish refugee called Dietrich Hampf, whose family had been sent to the gas chamber. They legally adopted him, they had no other children, and he stayed with them in Old Chapel Field for the rest of his life. Here's Dietrich and Heather talking about their lives together.
One, two-thirds of an apple each.
Excuse fingers.
Robin and Heather took me in as their son. It became a real family relationship. I think they're just lovely people to get on with. Always busy, full of energy. That's marvellous.
He became part of the family as the second we set eyes on him. Having it was almost like giving birth after all the struggle to get him.
Recently, I spoke to longtime local resident Jim Hall. Born in 1936, the same year as Rudyard Kipling's death, he tells me with a smile, he's lived on Jacksom's Lane all his life. He remembers the Tanners well.
She knows old soul, Mrs. Tanner, yeah. Mm. Yeah, Peter, he came over with a kinder transport, didn't he?
That's right.
Yeah. And they never used to like the hounds coming. We always used to love the hounds coming.
Yeah.
And you put a sign up, no hunting on our gate, something or other once. And
so how old were they, when you remember them, how old would the Tanners have been?
I suppose she'd been dead 20 years now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. They were getting on a bit when I knew them, yeah.
And how did you get to know them?
Well, we just sort of knew them, you know. Mm. Mrs. Tanner, she wasn't a bad old soul. She used to run around and things and put up, you know, about atom bombs and all the rest of it. Well, you can't. Once a veil's been invented, you can't.
Yeah.
You can't uninvent it.
So was Robin Tanner alive as well?
Yeah, he died before she did.
Mm.
No, but I always remember I used to, and I don't remember King Langley when we're falling out in a vehicle or something or other, and all of a sudden the foxfight came out of their thing and all the hounds after him. As I said, no one told the hounds that they weren't supposed to go there.
Geraldine Cousins, who lives in Draycott Cern, worked at Kington Langley post office when it was in the old forge on Upper Common. She remembers the Tanners well, their letters adorned with Robin's precise, almost Tolkien-esque calligraphy.
They were always so lovely to talk to. You could ask Heather about cooking or sewing or all sorts, as well as flowers, obviously. And she'd tell me how Robin would do the etchings. And Robin used to say we were the best village shop in England.
Indeed, Robin once went out of his way to help Geraldine's son, Tim.
Well, Tim had just started university. And Christmas came and they have a dinner that they're expected to wear the dinner suits for. And I just happened to mention to Heather that she'd obviously asked how Tim's getting on. And I said, well, he's looking forward to the Christmas meal, but he's going to have to hire a dinner suit to wear. And she went off back home and not half an hour later, Robin appeared with a parcel and said, Heather's told me that Tim needs to hire a dinner suit for the Christmas meal, but there's no need for him to go to that expense. He must have my suit because I won't be wearing this anymore.
Robin Tanner died at Old Chapel Field in 1988. He was followed by Dietrich in 1992. What a blessing, Heather told her friends, that Dietie has not been left alone. Village resident Betty Bird well recalls Heather hard at work outside her house.
Heather, she must have been in her 70s, always kept that ditch going up to the first of the double bends from here on her side of the road. She used to be in there clearing out that ditch to keep it tidy. She'd be horrified if she saw the mess of it now.
In 1991, at the behest of the local history group, Heather Tanner sat at her typewriter and wrote about her memories of Kington Langley in 1931 when she and Robin first arrived. It's 24 A4 pages long, double-spaced typing. Too much for this podcast, but here are a few extracts.
We set off down the village to ask Lime Tree Farm to include us in its morning milk round. It deserves a chapter in itself. The delivery was by horse and cart, and the milk was casually slopped from the measure into our jug while we asked Arthur Curtis for the weather forecast. The part of the village Robin knew best was the post office where his grandmother had lived. Her house was the main building of a complex called the Barton and was set at right angles to the thatched part, which had once been a cheese room and dairy. It was indeed the core of the village, including the smithy, conveniently opposite the forge, whose daily tinkling I found quite musical. Was the little pond in which Bob Martin's uncle called his wagon tires. The cottages on either side of the smith were owned by Mrs. Donner from the Ridge. Up Parker's Lane, we came to that central mark of punctuation, the Tump, a grassy mound naturally created by the converging of Parker's Lane in a T with Church Path, now Coffin Way. For how many centuries had children gambolled round and over that tump? Parker's Lane returned us to the main village road and upper common, with the mansion called the First on our left. Major Mackay walks with a stick and always wore a grey ascot-type bowler. Lime Tree Farm was a long two-storey building, still with its plaster front. Here lived old Mr. and Mrs. White, with their daughter and son-in-law, the Parkers. Old Mr. White was kindly by nature. The farm's small outbuilding, now a flat, was said to have once been a school, and later the home of Arthur Curtis, who delivered our milk. The newish double cottage next to it was for farm workers. We then reached Stock's Tree, still a large though decapitated elm. The stump was jealously guarded until it fell victim to Dutch elm disease, and it remains only in the name of the nearer house, once inhabited by Sol Cole, who baked bread and cake for the Sunday school retreats. Japonica Villa, opposite the pond, was the home of Maudie Phillips, Wiltshire Gazette correspondent for the Beaufort Hunt. She must have been an early user of the telephone, as her calls could be overheard at the exchange in the Barton post office.
And on she goes, mentally retracing that long ago walk around the village in 1931. It's a fascinating read. Although they are long gone, the Tanners and their simple rustic lifestyle still exert an attraction over artists and writers today. This is an extract from a blog by Bristol-based poet Deborah Harvey about a trip she made to Kington Langley a few years ago to see Old Chapel Field for herself.
The common was packed with people celebrating the annual Scarecrow Festival, so we made our way through the Morris dances and the fun fair and what can only be described as a crucifixion of scarecrows to make inquiries at the plant stall in the churchyard. I'm not really local, one of the stallholders told me. That is, I live here, but we don't really know the area. Probably drive past it every day, though. Well, could you point us in the direction of Robin Tanner's house, then? I asked the other woman. You know, the artist. She looked blank. Sorry, she said. Robin who? Eventually, we managed to orientate ourselves. But as we wandered back down the main street, it soon became apparent that the Tanner's much-loved village was now largely populated by well-heeled commuters, unfamiliar with its surroundings, or its former noteworthy inhabitants. It seemed ludicrous that in a place only a stone's throw from the M4, we would have been better off equipping ourselves with an OS map and compass than relying on local knowledge to find our way around. It was with a sinking feeling that we eventually drove back home. The Tanners had been acutely aware of the loss of countless features of the Wiltshire countryside and had sought to record and commemorate them through their art. But today it was apparent that there had been another loss, that of the connectedness of people to the landscape in which they live. It might just have been a coincidence, but I found it bewildering that every person we encountered seemed to lack even the vaguest acquaintance with their surroundings, let alone the intimate knowledge that comes from walking its tracks and woods and fields.
Deborah Harvey's comments sting me because, I have to admit, I knew virtually nothing about the Tanners until I started researching them. I'd heard they were artists of some kind, but nothing more. Now, having watched the old BBC documentary, read about them, looked at examples of Robin's etchings, I've gained more of an understanding of their work and about what they stood for. In essence, they were chroniclers of a bygone England, a pre-war Wiltshire of village folk who worked and socialised in their communities and who were intimate with the landscape in which they lived. How would the Tanners themselves respond to the Kington Langley of today? Well, back in 1991, as part of capturing her recollections for the local history group, Heather considered a similar question in this extract.
If one must compare the Kington Langley of 1931 with that of 1991, the village has lost much of its beauty. Only three or four of all the new houses look in keeping. Only one of the 12 farms is still farming. Westinghouse and Chippenham has swallowed up their labourers. The change from agriculture to industry is not our fault, and we have three worse enemies. The first is the M4, so useful in many ways, yet we have only to glance at the property advertisements to see the danger. Half a mile from the M4, easy access to M4. The car is another enemy, yet everyone now drives. As for speed, Kington Langley now has its lethal rush hour, like the town's. Tractors and lorries leave great ruts. More traffic, more noise. I cannot remember when I last heard the whitethroat's squeaky gravel, and this spring, the cuckoo called only in the distance. The worst possible enemy, however, is Thatcherism. A classic example of it is the developer, descending on some harmless rural community and destroying it to fill his own already overfull purse. So, in which era would I choose to live? 1931 or 1991? Fortunately, I neither need nor can choose all of either. So I would choose the best of both.
Shortly after she wrote this, Heather's health began to fail, as Betty Bird recalls.
She was getting rather frail because Dieter had died, so she was left on her own. Sometimes you saw her a lot. But one time she seemed a bit lost. I don't think I took her home, but I pointed her in the right direction, if you know what I mean.
Heather died in June 1993. The pastoral Wiltshire, so beloved of the Tanners, is now obscured by thick veneer of modernity. But perhaps, just perhaps, if you climb the stairs in Old Chapel Field and look southeast through the window, over the Poet's Gate, in the very farthest distance, you might still catch a glimpse of it. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Before I go, I just want to thank the BBC for allowing me to use the extracts from the 1982 documentary. This has been Memories of Kington Langley. Goodbye.